We dedicate our time together this morning to all those who are suffering. May we remember that our suffering and our well-being are shared. We acknowledge the Dakota and Anishinaabe peoples on whose traditional, ancestral, and indigenous and contemporary lands, clouds and water is an uninvited guest. For those of us who are not indigenous to these lands, may we commit to curiosity and engagement with the lives, justice movements, and sovereignty of the Native nations of this territory and beyond. We offer deep gratitude to our Indian, Chinese, and Japanese spiritual ancestors and contemporaries for all they have given us and for the chance to be here today. May we practice cultural humility. We recognize the Black community and the destruction of the historic Rondo neighborhood in which we practice. May we stand side by side in community care. We are all connected. May we work together for the liberation of all beings. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As Gyokujun said, I moved to a monastery when I was 21. And it was kind of a response to this aversion of what I thought like life was, like what life entailed. You know, I don't know if I wanted to like learn how to meditate or anything like that. I just wanted to like avoid money. You know? Avoid bills. I at 21 I had spent. I moved out of my parents' house when I was 17. And I got a job at Macy's in the Del Monte Shopping Center in Monterey, and I think I made $6.50 an hour. It's 1999. And I shared a room in a house that my uncle owned, but I didn't know him. It was just I'm related to, like everybody in Monterey. I think me and my friend Edgar shared a bedroom, and we paid $300 each, which really is like, so it was a two-bedroom for $1,200, which is what I'm paying now in Minneapolis, and this is 20 years ago in coastal California. Yeah. I just kind of, and then from there I moved to Santa Cruz, and then I moved to San Francisco, and I was in bands, and I worked at a record store, and I worked at a Blockbuster. And everything, and I kind of, any extra money I had, I kind of spent on, like, Thai food or something like that. I kind of just didn't, I didn't know I had ADHD, but I didn't know that I had impulsive, problematic spending, like, decision-making and stuff like that, you know? And I was just like, and my therapist was telling me, she's like, it was really wise of you to figure out that a monastery was a conducive environment for you to address your... how hard it was for you to, like, organize your mind in society, you know? So, because I always thought, well, I need some kind of formula to plug myself into. So it was kind of monastery or military, you know? But monastery kind of felt like it met a lot of my needs, but not all of them. And I've been thinking about this a lot, because someone from this Sangha is at a temple that I used to live at right now. We're communicating a little bit, and I'm getting to hear them giving me feedback on their experience of being there, you know. And so it makes me think about residential Buddhist temple life a little bit, and the perils and pitfalls of residential Buddhist temple life. And it took me a long time to put my finger on what some of the issues were for me. About 10 years ago, there was this teacher based out of Colorado who had kind of fallen from grace since then. Named Reggie Ray. Does anybody remember the Reggie Ray craze of 10 years ago? Mm-hmm. And I was listening to a Dharma talk by him, watching a video, and he goes, you know, it's like when you're sailing a sailboat. And he was speaking from experience. And I remember thinking, did this guy just say it's like when you're sailing a sailboat, like it's something that we've all done? You know, how out of touch is this guy? You know, in a cashmere sweater, you know, like, talking about sailing sailboats. I'm like, my dad used to pick me up from school in a garbage truck. You know, and when we were out of ketchup, we had to add water to it and shake it so that you got the rest out, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, oh, it's a class issue that I've been experiencing in Buddhism, you know? That kind of the bosses of my life were kind of rich people that didn't really get where I was coming from, you know? By and large. And I think that can be kind of troubling, especially a lot of times in the Zen tradition. There's this rhetoric within the Zen tradition that it's like, well, don't worry about the details. Just sit and see what happens. You know, and you don't have to learn Buddhism. We're not really concerned about learning Buddhism in Zen. We just do it. You know, That was my, and whenever I talk about this stuff, bear in mind that I trained in a very different setting than Clouds of Water. So I'm not talking necessarily about the approach of Clouds of Water. I'm talking about the approach that I experienced at San Francisco Zen Center. And it may or may not have similarities with what you've experienced. I don't know. But there's a little bit, even when you read books on Zen, they don't really get too much into a lot of the particularities sometimes. It's just kind of like this, like, kind of somatic practice, and you figure out for yourself what it means for you, you know. Which from one approach is kind of a safe way to do it, so that you don't come in kind of preloaded with conceptions or anticipations about what's going to happen, what's happening. Sometimes there could be a negative impact of that if you're relating to a teacher that doesn't really have comparable experiences to you, and life experience to you, that doesn't understand your temperament or your needs. I remember once having it explained to me by an older white Zen master, a real Zen master, what the point of monastic training was, you know, and it's about giving up your identity. He had done 9 months of it, and I had done 9 years of it. But he was explaining to me the value of it, and that I didn't really understand it. You know. What does it mean when somebody that's kind of an inheritor of the dominant culture went to tell you that you should be foregoing your identity, you know, or foregoing your attachment to your identity, you know. It hits different, you know. I think it's pretty misguided, you know. And if you do the approach to Zen where it's like, well, I don't need to figure out necessarily what this is all about, but I'm just going to follow my teacher, or follow, you know, the forms of the place where I'm practicing. And if I do it right, at some point something may or may not happen, you know. What's my point? I think we can benefit ourselves, and this is kind of the point of the class that I'm teaching. I'm thinking about this, and I just started teaching a class on Tuesdays. So day after tomorrow is our second meeting. And it's, when you have some context for what the agenda is behind any of this stuff, it helps you self-steer instead of just take everybody's word for it. You know, because whose word are you taking for it? You know, and is their needs your needs? Is their angle your angle? Is their life experience your life experience? Maybe, you know, someone giving up their preferences was really, really liberating for them, and so they tell you to do it. But maybe you honoring your preferences is a matter of survival. Yeah. So once we acquaint ourselves with the actual agenda of the teaching, and the actual agenda of meditation and the purpose of it, then we can start to make our own kind of informed decisions about what we're doing here, I think. That's my preamble. I was thinking about what to talk about, and I did manage to slip in that someone tried to school me, even though they'd done way less Manasseh training. So I'm proud that I got my petty moment publicly of that, because I've been holding on that for a year. And if anyone wants to hear me talk about just that, then we could put a day aside and I could talk to you about all the old men that are mean to me on the internet for not understanding truths then. So, what are we doing when we sit? So, from a kind of orthodox, traditional Buddhist view of psychology, your mind is beginningless. And when we say mind, we're not really talking about the brain. We're talking about the kind of electrical current that's running through all of your systems that has the capacity to know, or has the capacity to apprehend. You know, so if you've ever noticed, when you've ever read different versions of the Heart Sutra, it'll say ear, but then it also says ear consciousness. It'll say nose, but then it also says nose consciousness. Sometimes there's truncated versions that don't really separate those two, but if you read it, it says eye and eye consciousness, ear and ear consciousness, nose and nose consciousness. And those are distinct because from a Buddhist point of view, the ears just matter. You know, but the ear consciousness is the current that gives the ear the capacity to hear, that gives it the capacity to function, gives it the capacity to apprehend. So that kind of sparkle of the capacity to apprehend is what we call mind in Buddhism, or consciousness in Buddhism. Vijnana is the Sanskrit or Pali term, vijnana. So you have the nose vijnana, the ear vijnana, the tactile vijnana. Does this make sense? Because your skin is just skin, but then when it has the vijnana, then it can feel the sensation of touch. You know? So your thought processes have the, you know, there's the thought, which is the object of mind, and then there's the mind, which is not the object of mind. So that capacity to know. So the definition that I heard when I studied Tibetan Buddhism was, mind is that which is clear and knowing. So during the it wasn't really guided meditation, and I slid in the instructions right before it was time to change position or get up. But like earlier this morning, I said, you know, get curious about the nature of mind before the notions. You know, that is that which is clear and knowing. Now, Buddha's kind of deal is that your beginningless mind, and why is it beginningless? Because when we think everything is a result of cause and effect, you don't really get to have a first moment. Because the first moment, there must be a cause for that first moment. You know? So even Dalai Lama said, sure, Big Bang, but not the first Big Bang. there's a continuity to your consciousness. And this is the idea of rebirth. There's a continuity to it. Everything that's in your mind right now is resting upon the shoulders of everything that was in your mind in the previous mind moment. You know, and they're unfolding into each other, being influencing the nature of the next mind moment. And so Buddha says that your mind is perfumed through all of its experiences going back to beginningless time. That's why you could have, you know, twin siblings that have different temperaments, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, that when they were born, this mind stream, they inherited a mind stream that goes back endlessly. And so, based on that perfuming, and this perfuming is what we call karmic conditioning, based on this perfuming, you have inborn, and it's not like you're a clean slate when you were a baby. You have from before the beginning a mind that has predispositions. You know, I've never been able to enjoy mushrooms, the food. The other mushrooms that I wasn't crazy about either. But, and where did that come from? Is that a decision I made at some point? You know, did I in my lifetime have a specific negative experience that set the course for it? I don't think so. You know, it's just this mind has been perfumed for, you know, since it was a fish without, you know, a fish growing legs and crawling on the land or whatever, like a predisposition to not, I don't know, not like mushrooms or something, you know? And so, from a Buddhist psychology point of view, you're coming into contact. You have a conditioned mind that's coming into contact with objects. And when it comes into contact with objects, there's a very, very quick and subconscious communication that's going on with what we can call the storehouse consciousness or your emotional alert database. And it's kind of, there's a part of you that's like, from the point of view of my self-interest, is this a good thing or a bad thing, this thing that I'm apprehending? Yeah. And then you have what they call, and there's all these very technical terms from 2,000 years ago. You have a vedana, which is a feeling tone. And a feeling tone is positive, negative, or neutral, based on the object that you're encountering. And the feeling tone, the positive or negative feeling that arises after the contact with the object, is a result of the perfuming, a result of the karmic conditioning that goes back from the beginning of this time. So if I see something and I think it's bad, and then the next thing that arises is either attachment or aversion. I mean, aversion is attachment. It's just the other side of the coin, you know? And it's attachment is exaggerating the positive qualities of an object, thinking that proximity to it will ensure happiness. And aversion is exaggerating the negative qualities of an object, thinking that separation from it will cause happiness. Yeah. So we're doing our best with the information that we have. So I see an object totally innocent of my processes, of my above the board, of visible processes. I have a positive or negative experience of it. And then I either move towards or away from it. Try to perpetuate something or try to end something. You know, lean to or lean away. Yeah. And a couple weeks ago I gave a talk and I said, what is the mind that does not want things to stay the same and does not want things to change? Now, from a Buddhist point of view, when you experience that negative feeling, that's a result from encountering an object, that karma is done. That karmic seed is burnt out. That is over. That is, the fruition is the negative feeling. And you're done. Then what happens, though, is that that negative feeling turns over into attachment or aversion. And then when it turns over into attachment or aversion, in that moment, we take karmic fruition and plant it right back into our mind as karmic seed. So when we talk about shikantaza, when we talk about this practice of just sitting, there's two agendas. One, and from my point of view, someone else could, one of my internet bullies might tell you that I have it all wrong. One, I would say, is holding the heart open to experience the arising of the feeling tone. You know, if you sit still, all of these feeling tones are going to arise. Because even if you sit still, even if you close your eyes, even if you're in the quietest room ever, you're still going to have objects of consciousness. Notions are going to arise, sounds are going to arise, sensations are going to arise, and you're going to have positive or negative feelings about that. And the reason we say just sitting, nothing but sitting, is that you're letting those arise and you're letting those self-liberate. Because once that negative feeling or that positive feeling is the burning out or the fruition of the karmic seed. And you just don't move towards it or away from it, and you're actually liberated from karmic conditioning in that moment. You know? And you're acquainting yourself with the capacity and the felt experience of not being moved by feeling tone. The other thing that we're doing is in the process of watching that all unfold, we are disidentifying from the sense of mind as the content of thought versus mind as the field in which thought arises. And once you acquaint yourself with the sense of mind as the field in which thought arises, the field in which sensation arises, there's something that is very satisfying and nourishing about touching that part of ourselves. So this is what the session that didn't happen this weekend was going to be about. Touching the luminous mind. So in Zen we're doing two things. Letting the karmic seeds burn through holding ourselves open to positive and negative sensations that arise in response to any kind of apprehension of phenomena. And touching, acquainting ourselves with that capacity to know. You know, that sky-like or mirror-like quality of our mind that is not bound up with the particularities and the content. Now, sometimes people hear this and they think, okay, so Buddhism is all about ignoring all particularities and content. You know? But that is not, this term that we sometimes translate as right meditation, right livelihood, right, that's this Sanskrit word or Pali word, samma, which means integrated. Somehow some genius has translated it as right. But integrate. And so to hear this instruction and be like, you know, to acquaint yourself with the luminous quality of mind, it's like, well, then I will ignore all distinctions and particularities. That's not integrated. That's not samma. So it's, we are well-versed in particularities. We're not well-versed in the luminous quality of mind. You know? And we're not well, and then when you bring them together, it illuminates how the particularities function, because you're seeing them as the texture of the absolute. And then a lot of the times, the fixedness, you know, you see it as a sensible continuum. You know, oh, this person's acting this way, but of course they're acting this way. You know? I don't like this, but of course I don't like this. You know, so emptiness does give rise to compassion. You know, because the emptiness makes sense of the particularities as the texture of the absolute reality. You know, and there is no absolute reality outside of the texture of it through the particularities. So with that in mind, you get to figure out what mode of engaging this stuff is engaging this stuff. You know, you don't have to apologize for missing a session or not coming to the Zendo. If you want to, you can. It's great. You know, but actually, if you want to go for a walk, you can go for a walk. You can sit on your couch. You know, you can stay in bed. You can go to work, and you're letting the positive and negative Vedana, positive and negative feeling tones, arise and self-liberate. You know, you're getting in touch with the luminous quality of mind. These are things that formal practice, like I said the other week, formal practice is like a batting cage. You know, but we're playing the game all the time. I think that's good. Does anybody have any questions, comments? I had a teacher. Questions, comments, difficulties. Yeah.
I have a question. I have a question again.
Yeah.
And this idea of, sometimes I struggle with this idea of types of particularities. It seems like some are better than others. Mm. But then this idea of hierarchy seems to be anti-Zen. And so then it, you know, and then I, you know, usually I just kind of let it go. But if we could delve into it, why are some particularities better than others? Like, how How does that work?
What's a better particularity in this example?
An example would be eating when you're hungry, or just staving it off and then falling over. You know, like what, you know, and not eating, and then being, you know, hangry, and then, you know, yelling at people because you're hungry. Like, so I can use my understanding is you use your experience that didn't work out so well yesterday, and you do that today. But there's this Zen can kind of be sometimes convoluted, because then I'm not really just only open to the moment. I'm thinking about how I did yesterday, and I'm changing the moment so that I don't do it today. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also grading particularities.
Yeah. Okay, let me try it with this. Flossing would be really bad for you if you did it all day. You know? And I never do it, and it would probably be good for me to do it. You know? Me, Mina, and Daishin all go to this gym, and we all lift weights. And it's easy. I can feel really good afterwards, and I feel like my body's like solid, you know, and I like that feeling. So then I'll get it in my head, I'll go back and do it tomorrow. Or instead of doing 2 hours, I'll do 4 hours. Mm. But lifting weights don't work like that. If you do it all the time, it's really destructive, you know. So the thing that makes you strong would make you weak if you did it all the time. So I feel like in this practice, it's kind of like all of this is so that what, you know. And the so that what is reducing unnecessary vexation for self and other. You know? So if you take this prescription to acquaint yourself with the luminous mind, or to let positive and negative sensations arise and cease without you know, responding to it with attachment or aversion. If you take that to its logical conclusion, like, well, then I'm just doing that all the time. You know, I mean, there's a reason that Himalayan yogis go on retreat instead of that just like being, they're just like, and they have a distinction. This is time when it's meditation, and this is time when it's not. You know? And I think it's like we're learning how to do this exercise so that we increase our capacity to have more say in our lives. You know? So I think it's to increase your capacity to have more say, not to decrease your capacity to have. It's not like, well, but by flexing that muscle, it's you're preparing yourself for the circumstances which you can't change. So there's a great, have you ever heard of Hyakujo's fox or Baijong's fox? It's a koan. And it's like the longest koan with the longest commentary, and then there's books about it, like the books are this thick, about like a 2-page thing. But the story goes that it's kind of weird, because there's a sermon given, and then someone comes up to the abbot that gave the sermon and said, a monk comes up and says, I used to be the abbot of this monastery, but I gave a wrong answer, and I was reborn for 500 years as a fox. Which I never figured out why he wasn't a fox when he was asking that question. And he goes, so let's see if you can liberate me by giving me the right answer. I was asked if an enlightened person is subject to cause and effect. And I said, no, an enlightened person is not subject to cause and effect. And I was reborn as a fox. What would you say? And then the abbot in the story goes, I would say an enlightened person is not ignorant of cause and effect. And I think that's a really, really important distinction. So we could think, well, our practice is about not concerning ourselves with cause and effect and just taking everything as it comes and being in the moment, whatever that means. You know? But I think actually, there's this term, another one of those Sanskrit words that start with the letter V. I forget what it is. But it means discernment. You know, and we're developing the capacity for discernment as well. But it's just by exercising the muscles that we're not usually exercising. You know, getting curious about the luminous mind. You know, equating ourselves with the feeling of having negative arising without doing anything about it. Because sometimes it's not as simple as eating food that makes you feel better. Sometimes it's you know, it's something that you do have the capacity to do something about. Sometimes it's like one time there was a storm coming. We got those little beep, beep, beeps on our phone, and it said there was like a wind advisory or something like that. And Minna, who's used to the Midwest, was like, we need to bring our outdoor furniture to the basement. And I was just like, I don't want to. Because it was like, I don't know, it was like 8 p.m. or something like that. And I'm just like, and it's like cold and windy out there or whatever. And I'm like, no, I don't want it. And I was like, I threw like a literal tantrum about moving the lawn furniture down to the basement. You know, and I'm like, what the hell was that? You know, and like part of our practice is that feeling tone of negative, you know, and just being like, all right, so there's something in this beginningless, unfathomable karmic mind that does not want to do this, but this is what's up, you know. So you're having, so you're increasing your ability to take care of life as it is. Was that too long-winded, or was that, did that feel like it matched that? Okay. How much time do we have? 18 minutes. Wow. Mm-hmm. Minna.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how to ask this question, so I hope you'll bear with me. So I was just in a really great training yesterday for techniques for trauma-informed facilitation. And you know, we were talking about the overlaps between trauma-informed space-holding, you know, facilitation. Mm-hmm. And consent, and you know, what does consent mean, and how do you feel the spectrum of consent within your own body, and how is that, you know, body, heart, and mind, and how is that related to a facilitator facilitating folks to be able to feel into that spectrum, mm-hmm. The goal being to be able to choose from maybe, like, that space of the luminous mind, to be able to choose the level to which you're participating so that it's healthy for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question is, you know, thinking about the emptiness and its texture of particularities and increasing our capacity to touch into and, like, move in luminous mind, move from luminous mind, or, you know, stick our fingers in the texture from luminous mind. Does that feel like I guess, yeah, does it feel like acquainting, you know, for you, like acquainting yourself with luminous mind is kind of akin to being able to be more choiceful.
Mm-hmm.
In each moment around the degree to which you participate, and in this context, like, oh goodness, I think going to the Zendo isn't appropriate for me right now, or, you know, like that kind of thing. I don't know, there's this, like, I have as a person who's going to be stepping in onto the ordination path in the fall, I have this sort of constant koan around, like, willingness and, you know, like trying things on even when they're uncomfortable, like showing up even when, you know, versus like trusting the wisdom or the luminous mind and its illumination of the textures.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think so.
Weird question, but
I think
so.
So, what's good about emptiness? You know? What's good about that which is clear about the luminous mind, you know? And it's like, the only thing that's really good about it is that it kind of makes you happy and fortifies you for your life. You know? You could know about it or not know about it, or like, it's, and you could live a good, and you could be harmless without knowing about it. You know, you could be a person that creates good conditions for self and others without really getting into the luminous mind thing. The thing about the luminous mind thing is that it's a little, it's like a nice big bag of Big League Chew. For it's just like juicy and satisfying, you know. So it's a nice place to, and it's a place that creates the conditions of rest, you know. And it's nice to have it on, and have it as a point of reference and have it on recall. In terms of willingness, consent, you know, my teacher always used to say the best practice is the one that you do. And I think we are, I think it's an okay thing to be curious about and be okay without knowing the answer. I remember when we were doing back squats at the gym. So the back squats, when you have the bar on your shoulders and you go down and up. And I thought I was like maxed out. And Daishin looked at me and she's like, "You're not even trying yet." I don't know what she said exactly. I might not have been that harsh. It's kind of like, you don't even look like you're having a hard time yet, you know? And I'm like, I think this is it for me. And so we put on like another like 20 pounds and I could do that. You know? And I just found out it took me like, you know, a good 9 months of kind of not quite knowing what maxed out for me was. Believing something kind of lower, not knowing what effort was the right amount of effort, you know? Now, is it true that I had all of that in me all along and that I wasn't doing it? Or was it true that something had to kind of turn around for me in that moment? And it was kind of like the perfect storm of me having enough months under my belt and Daishin being there, and it's the exercise that I had the most confidence in. So it's this weird little cocktail that kind of creates the circumstances for a breakthrough into more willingness. You know, and it can't really be it's not independent of the influence of others, but it can't really be dictated by the influence of others. Because if we were loading up the bar and Daishin's like, "No, you're gonna back squat 150 right now," I'd be like, I don't think I can. It had to happen the way that it happened. You know, and the person watching could be totally wrong. You know, and so that's another thing to consider. You know. They could be like, "Well, you know, it's like when you sail the sailboat." Thanks. So does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that example a lot. Yeah.
We have somebody on Zoom.
Okay.
I don't know if you can read it from there, but Glenn said, could you also be interpreted as equanimity arises from our practice? And then he offers a quote about equanimity from Insight Meditation.
Yeah.
I can read it if you'd like.
Yeah, talk louder.
Yeah, yeah, let's...
Okay. Equanimity is one of the most sublime emotions of Buddhist practice. It is the ground for wisdom and freedom and the protector of compassion and love. While some may think of equanimity as dry neutrality or cool aloofness, mature equanimity produces a radiance and warmth of being. Mm. The Buddha described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will.
Yeah. Okay. So, this is a thing that I think the Zen tradition kind of goofs on a lot of the time. When I went, after 10 years of San Francisco Zen Center, I went and studied Tibetan Buddhism with my friend, I'm so glad, Venerable Tenzin Choki, who's like a 6-foot-tall nun from Santa Cruz. And she taught this 10-day course on Namrin, which is like the stages of the path in the Tibetan tradition. And what was the point of that?
Equanimity.
Oh, and they started talking about this stuff when I got there. And then we're talking about meditation there, and they're talking about... they do these prayers before you sit, and they talk about... the cultivation of wholesome mind states and the relinquishing of negative mind states. And from a Zen tradition, I'm like, that's kind of dualistic, right? Is there such a thing as a positive and negative mind state? You know? And it's like, okay, great. I could come at it from the absolute and think there's no such thing as a positive or negative mind state. And where does that leave me? You know, it's kind of like jokes on me by pretending like these conventionalities are not helpful. Because guess what happens when you cultivate positive mind states? You know, and it creates the feeling of safety and okayness and generosity and disidentification from your own feeling of scarcity, so that you are more likely to feel flexibility when negativity arises in the mind, and you are more likely to see the emptiness of all compound phenomena because you're not constantly protecting the self. If your predisposition is constantly protecting the self, you know, then, and you say, well, I'm not going to bring in positive or negative mindsets because those aren't absolute reality. It's kind of like, well, you're going to just end up stewing in what's already there. So you got to bring in these foreign things like joy, you know? And then when I first encountered, you know, the story of there's these four emotions. Compassion, friendliness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And equanimity is considered the most important, but it's kind of built upon the foundation of the other three. And the way that these four came about, there's of the many lists, Buddha, in Buddhist time, he loved to make little lists out of things. And someone said, how do we dwell with God? You know, how do we live with Brahma? And so these emotions were called God's house, Brahma Vihara. Sometimes they say the Brahma Viharas. That means dwelling with God or being in God's house. You know? And so, but all of these emotions have near enemies. There's the opposite, which is the enemy, and then there's the near enemy, which is something that it looks like. You know, and I remember, I just talked about this last week at my class. When I first started in Zen, I thought I had it all figured out. And I went and told my teacher, like, you know, I'm fine. I'm okay with everything that happens. And he's like, oh, that's the near enemy of equanimity. Because you're aloof. You've detached yourself from any involvement, any heart involvement with the world and with others. You know? And it's actually really easy to be aloof when you have privilege. It's like right there. You know? So equanimity is this thing that can look, you know, and that's the danger when we're not cultivating. So I think trying to go straight to equanimity without cultivating the mind, the mental, you know, the capacity for compassion, capacity for friendliness, the capacity for sympathetic joy, you know, and build your equanimity on that. In fact, you don't even have to worry about the equanimity. Yeah. Because without that foundation, the equanimity can just be pulling the plug on. Mm-hmm. All right, 10:19. Want to finish a minute early? All right, thanks everybody.
Thank you.